I mentioned that cooperative negotiators tend to use understatement and to feel that the truth will speak for itself. Aggressive negotiators are under no such illusion. In fact, their impression is that the truth often is not adequate for the task at hand. And hence, item number 8, they're willing to stretch the facts. Question, how far are they willing to stretch? Well, I know of no limit. How gullible are you is kind of the question. And now, in a way, I mean, you can tell I'm basically a cooperative negotiator, and there's kind of a judgment in the way I say that, as if cooperatives are the ones who are moral and ethical and aggressives are not. But from the aggressive point of view, it is equally moral and ethical the way they do it. And here is how to think about that. Cooperatives make the major presumption that even though they only know half of the case, they can decide what is fair, and they keep themselves within the bounds of what they think is fair. Well, aggressives see that as just simply untenable. Their attitude is, I have no idea how far the other side is willing to go, therefore I have no idea what is fair. And the only way I can find the outer limits of truth is to push you as far as I can push you by every means at my disposal. And as long as you keep being pushed, you must not have good facts or else you would be firmer than where you are. So as long as I push and you keep moving backwards, I assume we haven't reached the outer limit of truth. So rather than being a self-monitor, aggressives pound on the other side and monitor how far they're willing to go. And it's just two different attitudes about how you find the outer limits of what is acceptable. And that's the aggressive point of view. Now, as different as they are up here at the top of these two columns, they share a lot in common. And what the cooperative and aggressive effective share in common, I've summarized all at the bottom of page 92. They're prepared by their own standards. Both sides are ethical and honest. Both feel it's very important to observe the customs and courtesies of the bar. They are seen as perceptive and skillful in reading the cues given off by the other side. Both sides take satisfaction in using their legal skills. Number 6 is very interesting. All of the research we've done in every context shows that cooperative or aggressive, you must be seen as reasonable, realistic, rational, analytical, and it's that makes you convincing. You can't be too wild-eyed or too extreme in your demands or your arguments. Both sides are seen as effective trial attorneys, and both sides are seen as quite self-controlled, that they don't wander off the track in response to unanticipated events. Okay, now those are the effective negotiators. Would you just leave the book open so that you can see page 92, and let us also look at 93, because page 93 is now looking at the bottom end, the ineffective cooperative and ineffective aggressive, but we'll want to refer back and see how they compare to their effective counterpart. Now, the cooperative ineffective in the left-hand column of 93, their objectives: conduct themselves ethically, maximize settlement for the client. And those two are identical, notice, to page 92. Number 3, here's a new one. They also are concerned with meeting their client's needs, which seems hard to argue with. But look at number 4. It's also important for them to maintain good relations with their opponent. It sounds to me like it's important to them that they be liked, or the important that they be loved. And we'll return to that theme in a second. And then, of course, number 5, they like to get a fair settlement, in the sense that they limit themselves within the bounds of what their view of fairness would be. Now let's look at their traits. They're trustworthy, ethical, fair, honest. And that looks just nearly identical with their cooperative, effective counterpart. Now, number 2, they are trustful. Now, there's no word on page 92 that looks like trustful. If you look up trustful in any dictionary, a synonym is gullible. And another synonym is naive. And so it appears that to be trustful in negotiation with lawyers is to be gullible and naive. And the better rule would be never give your trust. Make them earn your trust. Make them earn your trust rather than give it freely. Now, number three, they're courteous, personable, sociable, friendly. And that looks okay compared to page 92. But now look at this fourth cluster, gentle, obliging, patient, forgiving. It does occur to me that gentle, obliging, patient, forgiving, those are considered primary virtues in every religious and philosophical system on earth. So am I standing here saying you've got to take a choice between living a life with human virtues or being effective, that they're mutually exclusive? And I'm happy to say not at all, because to be gentle, obliging, patient, forgiving, that is virtue if you do it out of strength and you do it by choice. If you do it out of strength and do it by choice, that is virtue. But if you think you always have to do that, if that's the only way to be, that is not virtue. That is pathology. It is a disease. And it's a disease I grew up with. In my home, you had to be nice. And for example, at the table, you had to always say please. So if you wanted the salt, you had to say, please pass the salt. And if you didn't say please, you didn't get the salt. You got a lecture. So I married a woman who, just two or three days into our marriage, she looked at me and said, pass the salt. I've married a monster. You know, this will never work. She didn't say please. Now, see, that's a problem not in her. It's a problem in me that thought you have to be so nauseatingly nice all the time. And so I believe that cooperatives all have some of that in them, the belief that you have to be loved and the way to be loved is to be nice. It is some comfort to me that they are intelligent in the process and that they are dignified as they give it all away. And of course, they're very self-controlled. So what do we have here? This is the classic marshmallow. You know, this is Casper or Casperina milquetoast. And as I mentioned, I was born and raised a milquetoast. My mother used to say, Jerry, I don't know the road to success in life, but I know the sure road to failure, and that is having to please all of the people all of the time. Now, that is the same mother who said you have to always say please when you ask for the salt, you know. So there's a little tension in what she's trying to teach me. But that's the burden that cooperative and effective have, that they want to be loved, and the way to be loved is be nice. And in clinically, it is called the passive-aggressive personality. Lawyers have a lot of this in them, especially cooperative lawyers. A leading clinical symptom of passive-aggressive personality is a failure to return phone calls. The most frequently frequent complaint against lawyers is a failure to return phone calls. So it is a symptom of this problem that cooperatives have to deal with. And so the goal, in my opinion, or my understanding for cooperatives, is to seek mature expression of this cooperative strategy and not to do it out of a personal need to be loved by whoever. Now, let's quickly look now at the aggressive ineffective on the right-hand column of 93. These are my personal favorite because the highest rating on any adjective for them is this word irritating. Why are they so irritating? Well, it's all summed up in number two and three. Number two says they're unprepared on the facts and on the law, so they don't bother to prepare. Therefore, it is a bluff, whatever they ask for. They make extreme opening demands. You say, what on earth do you have to back up that demand? And rather than supporting it with information and argument, they say, take it or leave it. And so rather than doing their homework and persuading, what they do is make an extreme demand and attack you. So they're attacking, quarrelsome, demanding, argumentative, and of course, aggressive. This fourth cluster, egotistical, headstrong, rigid. You know the book, The Culture of Narcissism, the sense of being entitled to it because I'm me, that's personified by the aggressive and effective. You have to give it to me because I'm insisting on it. I need it so much. And then there's cluster five, bordering on a clinical condition. They are arrogant, disinterested in the needs of other human beings. They're very intolerant and very, very hostile. So they are not passive aggressive. They are overtly aggressive. And they are in elementary school, these are the schoolyard bullies. You know, these are the ones that gave kids bloody noses at recess. And in elementary school, they've worked, I suppose, since the first school was formed, at work identifying the bullies and trying to get them quit beating up on people. Nothing they have done with bullies has ever stopped them from beating up on people. About 25 years ago, someone had the insight to ask, well, I wonder who's getting beat up. And they found it is a identifiable small group of kids that get beat up, and they have in common a set of behaviors that are now known as victim behaviors. And they are very teachable, and if you use videotape, you can quickly teach them to quit behaving like victims. And when they quit behaving like victims, the bullies stop beating them up. So in a very perverse way, it is as if the victim says, beep, 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 I need a bloody nose. And the bully says, you know, here I am, I'll do it. But it is in response to cue. And so is to teach the victim, in elementary level at least, not to beep, beep victim behavior. Now, we need to be careful with generalizing from that, because it is not clear, for example, in spouse abuse, the extent to which victim behavior is a factor. Surely it's partially a factor, but it isn't known really yet whether it's a small or a large factor. So we'll be cautious to generalize, but at least at the elementary school, the victim behavior is part of the pathology. And it is identified, of course, with masochism. It's an unconscious feeling that you can absorb a punishment. And this is not the sexual bondage stuff. This is, in the literature, it's identified with someone who has interest in a more spiritual life. And in the Christian tradition, of course, that's captured in the idea of turn the other cheek. And so the concept of turning the other cheek is virtue if you do it out of strength and by choice. But if you feel you have to do it, then that is not virtue, but pathology. And likewise, the aggressive, the pathology there is not masochistic, it's sadistic. It's taking pleasure in hurting other people and exploiting your ability to do that. And so the goal for aggressives, I think all aggressives have some of the sadistic in them. All cooperatives have some of the masochistic in them. The goal for each one is to move towards a mature expression of those negotiator qualities and not have them driven by those immature impulses. Now, are we together that far? Now, I've worked from 1973 up till about late 1989, worked with these two patterns. They are enormously rich. And there is now a large literature drawing out of this research that seeks to help us if we're basically cooperative to be effective cooperative, if you're basically aggressive to be an effective aggressive. But I've also found that there is a limit to how much you can learn if you restrict yourself just to cooperation and aggression. And I've asked the question beginning about 3.5 years ago, is there not a larger set of a larger category, say if we move cooperation down here and say these are our cooperatives, and we move the aggressives down to a parallel column, so this is the aggressive strategy, is there not a larger category or an ideal type that is larger than and would include the cooperative negotiator qualities, but that would be richer and have more drawing power in terms of helping us know how to carry these traits in a mature way in our negotiation? And is there not a larger category or an ideal type that would be larger and more useful than, but would include the aggressive negotiating strategy? And I believe there are two such categories, and they're the ones I mentioned in the introduction this morning, that the larger social role of cooperative negotiators is that which has always been identified with the healer in human society. And the larger social role of aggressive negotiators has always been identified with that of the warrior. Now, if we use those categories, they become very useful, and in a couple of ways. One way would be to acknowledge that it is rare in our day to see a mature healer. It is equally rare in our day to see a mature warrior. Our clients, when they seek us out as lawyers, are usually looking for a mature warrior because they feel under serious attack and they need to be protected by a great warrior. If the process works, however, what they ultimately need is a mature healer. So what our clients are looking for in us is not merely the mature healer or the mature warrior, it is some of both. That at the appropriate time we can defend them as a warrior would, but at the appropriate time we can shift over and become a healer so they can get on with their lives. And so I believe our developmental task as lawyers is to learn to embody or personify or to access the mature qualities of a healer and at the appropriate time shift over to the mature qualities of a warrior and know when and how to make that shift. Now, if that's true, let me make the next point to say these are not gendered categories. Neither one is exclusively male or exclusively female. And to sort of develop what they really do stand for, let's look at the warrior for a minute and say, how about women? Who are some women in current events or in history or in mythology who we could look to as people who carry the mature warrior energy? Anybody help me? Who would you look to for warrior energy? Margaret Thatcher. What is her nickname? The Iron Lady. So it's an honor for all of us to live in a day when Margaret Thatcher is operating because she carries really great warrior energy. What's warrior energy? Well, if you turn to page 94, right-hand column, it says the warrior, mature warrior objectives use their powers only for a larger good. If you sell your powers to anyone, what are you? You're not a warrior, you're a mercenary, right? Secondly, they defend individuals from, and I suppose we should put individuals and communities from threatened chaos. And three, very interesting, they must tolerate immature warriors. And then what are the traits? Well, one set of traits is they're expert tacticians and strategists. They have great mental and physical stamina for battle. The people who are working on this think that you cannot get through law school without having some good warrior energy. It takes a lot of stamina to make it through those 3 years. Secondly, they're vigilant. And they quickly discern enemies. Now, vigilance is always tied to boundaries. Warriors establish and defend boundaries. That's a distinguishing factor. And by definition, you cannot be a warrior unless there are enemies. You can only be a warrior if you have enemies, because the warrior energy is a response to enemies. So the warriors are vigilant, they establish and protect boundaries. Margaret Thatcher has this fabulous warrior energy. She established and protected the boundaries against Great Britain. However, Great Britain at the current moment in history needs to get into the European economic community. Margaret Thatcher is so full of warrior energy, she wasn't going to let it happen. She was defending the boundary too much. So they had to get her out of office in order to lower the boundary enough to continue the steps towards entering the economic community. So both the strength and the weakness of warriors is that they see the world in terms of enemies, they establish and protect boundaries. Now, who are some other women warriors we might look to? Hillary Clinton, lover or hater, but boy, she's got fabulous warrior energy, and people are really really seeing that. Who else? If you're going to see the movies, who would you see? What would you see? There's a series of three if you want to see warrior energy spectacularly. That Aliens 1, 2, and 3, Sigourney Weaver. Wow, talk about warrior qualities. Joan of Arc, I suppose. Ingrid Bergman got an Academy Award for her portrayal of Joan of Arc. But those would be some models to look to. I think they tend to be culture specific, but those are some. Who are some male warriors that we might look to? And if you're going to see one movie to pick up male warrior, it wouldn't be Schwarzenegger, wouldn't be Rambo. Those are too fanciful. Who would be a great warrior? I guess Clint Eastwood in about anything. And before him, John Wayne. I mean, they really did carry kind of that warrior. If you're going to look at military, one movie I would recommend would be Patton. And that's George C. Scott playing George S. Patton. And some of the qualities of warrior, the self-sufficiency, the attention to dress and appearance, the recognizing the importance of seeing and being seen by the troops on the front line. So he had a lot of positive warrior qualities, but he was limited. Remember, he could not tolerate immature warriors, for one thing. And he was vigilant to the point of paranoia. World War II is over, and he wants to keep fighting. And so he self-limited in his capabilities because he wasn't mature in his energy. Now, that the idea of tolerating immature warriors, the movie to see on that, well, the samurai tradition is this. The samurai tradition is that any great warrior is always going to be challenged by the young punks, because you can get instant fame if you kill a great warrior. And every Western movie in the traditional mode, you know, has this as a thing. Well, in the samurai tradition, there's a story that the great warrior is forever being challenged by the young, immature warriors, the punks, as they would call them, I guess. And the mature warrior has no ego need to show how tough he or she is. And so they would say, no, I'm not going to fight you. But if it is absolutely irresistible, the mature samurai says, all right, I will fight you. But in deference to my age, let's not fight in front of all these people. Let's row across the river, and there's nobody over there. I'll fight you over there. And so the young punk says, okay, but you have to row the boat. So the old samurai rows him across the river, and the young punk jumps up on the bank and says, come on, I'm going to cut you to pieces. And the old samurai takes a deep breath and rows the boat back across the river, you know, and leaves the young upstart there to think about it. Because if the great warrior got out and fought a young upstart, he would have to kill the young upstart. But mature warriors tolerate immature warriors, and they don't want to have to kill them. They have hope that with time they're going to grow up and mature and learn to serve the community. So that's the tradition of great warriors. Now, do you want to see a movie that captures that beautifully? It's an unexpected place to look, Crocodile Dundee. Yeah, Crocodile Dundee. How many have seen Crocodile Dundee? This is the first Crocodile Dundee. Remember in Crocodile Dundee, get about halfway through it and have your finger by the pause button of your VCR. And there's a scene about in the middle where Crocodile, he's been installed in this high-priced New York hotel room, remember? And he's just out of the bathtub And he's on the phone calling his buddies down in Australia, telling them he thinks he's in love and he's going to stay longer in New York. As soon as the camera hits him out of the tub on the phone to Australia, hit the pause button. Because they're in the frame. They're in the picture frame. You see the following qualities of the warrior. Number one, he's dripping out of the bathtub. He's still got the towel wrapped around him. But he has on his cowboy hat and his cowboy boots. Because warriors keep the essential equipment on, you know, at all times. So there in his cowboy boots, and the window is open. Why is the window open? It's summer, it's hot. Well, partly because warriors don't use air conditioning. You know, that would weaken their defense system. And partly because he's drying his clothes. Because warriors are self-sufficient. He's just done his own laundry in the tub, and he's strung a clothesline up in the room, and they're hanging up to dry. And then at his feet on the floor is a pillow and a blanket. Why? Because warriors sleep on the floor. You know, they're not going to sleep on some mattress and lose their discipline and toughness. So there in one frame are all of those qualities of warriors. The very next frame, get your finger on the spot, ready for the pause button again. Very next frame, he and the New York reporter are coming up out of, that he thinks he's in love with, they're coming up out of the subway at night in New York City, and you see it in your mind's eye, and they walk past some white pillars, and suddenly a young mugger jumps out and says, "Hey, buddy, do you have a light?" And as soon as their forward progress stops, the young mugger pulls a switchblade and says, "I'll take your wallet, too." And this kind of a wonderful moment, the New York reporter says to Crocodile, "Crocodile, give him your wallet." No, she doesn't want any heroics. And Crocodile says, "Why should I?" And she says, "Because he has a knife." And Crocodile says, "Nah, that ain't a knife. This is a knife." And he pulls out that 18-inch Bowie knife. "This is a knife," he says. And by now, the one mugger is joined by two more switchblades. And so he's facing three people with this knife. Remember the old Zorro movies? First, he goes, zoot, 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 and he cuts a Z in the outer coat of this lead mugger. Then he holds that big knife under the nose of the lead guy, and he backs him up. Well, they turn tail and run. Now, here's the mature warrior. The instant they run, he puts the knife away and says, "Just kids having fun." Okay. See, now, that's tolerating the mature warrior. Then he thinks, "What about, you know, my date? What about her?" And he looks back, and she's leaning kind of against one of these white pillars. And he says to her, "Are you all right?" And as soon as the camera turns to her, hit the pause button, because she's standing like this, and her eyes are aglow. She is filled with adoration. Now, that adoration is not just her. She is adoring the mature warrior energy for us all. You know, if you want to be adored, develop mature warrior energy, because it is irresistible. Every law firm and every corporate law department deserves to have a mature female or male lawyer who carries that energy and carries it so lightly that it's positively appealing. Okay, that's warrior energy. How about healers? But healers, are there any women we might look to as mature carriers of healing qualities? Eleanor Roosevelt had a lot of healers. Who else might we look to? Anyone alive today come to mind? Mother Teresa. It's the other MT here. We've got Margaret Thatcher, and we have Mother Teresa. And there's a video by that name, Mother Teresa, that's a documentary of her life that captures it. Now, remember we said warriors establish and defend boundaries. What do healers do? Healers lower and transcend boundaries. So here's Mother Teresa in India, riddled with divisions based on class and based upon ethnic and religious groups. And she is inviting everyone to lower the boundaries and to go across them with human compassion. So the healer's role is exactly opposite that of the warrior. Who are some male healers we might look to? If you see only one movie out of all we've talked about so far, I would suggest Gandhi. Now, how do you watch these movies? Well, I would suggest you turn back, I think, to page 87. You turn back to 87, and you look about a third of the way down the page. What qualifies professionals to be entrusted with the lives and fortunes of people who are vulnerable and in crisis? Well, and you look at that list of special knowledge, special powers, set apart by dress and foods and demeanor, use their powers only in appropriate times and places, how they protect confidences, and their transpersonal commitment that they never use their power to serve their own interests. If you will keep that list on your lap and see any one of these movies, you will be astonished at how those qualities define the very essence of what the great healers and the great warriors are doing, that those are the true qualities of professionals in that sense.
This is the end of Tape 3, Side 1. The program continues on Side 2.
Now, if we think of Gandhi, we could think of Martin Luther King, the great follower of Gandhi. I suppose if you're north of the Mason-Dixon line, you say Abe Lincoln. If you're south, or back wherever you are, you've got to say Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee is one of the few who had great warrior energy and then great healer. And I mean, read any biography of Robert E. Lee. And notice that to be a great healer requires a lot of warrior energy. It requires enormous courage to confront injustice and really face it. In fact, you may well pay for it with your life. Gandhi, King, Lincoln, and we could add some others. But society doesn't like mature healers because they threaten the established order. Okay, let's see, where are we? So that gives you some idea. The warriors tend to have less healers in them. They don't, it's hard to get a list of warriors who go back and forth, although Robert E. Lee does. Another one that occurs to me, maybe you can help me think of some others, is Marshall. Who's the Marshall of the Marshall Plan? George C. Marshall, because he was a great general during World War II and then was the author of the Marshall Plan, which went back to heal the war-torn countries, including Germany that had been the enemy. So Marshall, you'd have to say, really did manage to cross those, and I'm sure we can think of some other examples as well. But there was MacArthur. He was a great warrior. Oh, that, in fact, he was the post-war leader in Japan, wasn't he? And had healers. So it is possible to find some that really have managed to be great in both categories. And I do personally believe the developmental task for us as lawyers is to learn to operate out of either of those modes as appropriate. Now let's see. You might ask, okay, if I manage to do that, or if I would like to manage to do it, how should I do it? And if I manage to do those two, would I be a whole person? Would I be a complete human being? And the people that are working with the metaphor of healer and warrior would say, no, actually, that's just half a person. And if you want to be a whole person, you need two more. And one of them would be called the king or queen, the qualities within each individual, in each one other, that is identified historically with the role of the great king or the great queen. And what are those qualities? These are the qualities of being centered. That's what we would say about them today. They're very centered. Or they have good structure in their lives, and historically that's called the right order. You know, they are able to establish the rules that would give structure and good process The king or queen is always generative. Their role is to be a resource and a blessing to those around them. And of course, in the Western tradition, you look to any of the great kings or queens in England or France or any of the other cultures that you might be familiar with. King Arthur kind of carries that for a lot of Westerners. But the king in the right order is not everything, because the fourth one is called the lover. And I'm not allowed to talk about this in Utah, but what are the qualities of the lover? The lover, it is the ability in each of us to take delight. It's the ability to take delight in nature, in the natural world, and especially to take delight in other people. And when you're in the lover mode, when you're in love, puppy love or whatever kind of in love, you're in the lover mode. And the sky is bluer and the grass is greener and the birds sing sweeter when you're in that lover mode. Now, if you want to see a movie for lover mode, the first one that comes to my mind is Anthony Quinn in Zorba the Greek. In fact, Anthony Quinn in anything, is that's lover energy. He just takes delight. If you want to read it, read Elizabeth Barrett Browning. When you read her sonnet to the Portuguese, she's touching love, pure lover energy when she wrote those. Or read anything by Emily Dickinson or anything by Walt Whitman. Notice that lover, this is always, it's poetry and art, it tends not to be prose, although if you read D.H. Lawrence, I mean, he was touching that pure lover energy. So any of those, you'll notice that you don't want to marry someone or you don't want to be someone who is just pure warrior, because warriors sacrifice their own interests to a higher cause. They sacrifice their family and friends and they're just warriors. Or healers sacrifice their family and friends. So you or your spouse, you want, if you're in the workplace, you do this during the day. When you come home, you can shift over to king or queen, and then when you get the kids to bed, you can shift over and be a lover. But because you don't want to just live in one of these, the thought is. Now that's a bit of a field. So let's come back and say, the ones we're concerned with are cooperative and aggressive, or we're calling them healer warrior. If you would like to find them in yourself in their mature forms, how do you do it? And let's end this session with this. Ones who are working on this say, we usually begin in denial. Oh, I could never do that. It isn't in me. Now, cooperative say, I could never be a good aggressive. It isn't in me. So the second step, if we're going to ever feel it and experience it, is to accept the possibility that it is in you. And in fact, the geneticists are saying it's genetically coded in you. It's already there. You just need to learn how to find it and give action to it. And then the third step is to see it in others. To learn what it's like, and that's why movies and books are so important, because you can see it and read it and actually start to have some sense of what it really means, and then you must experience it. You must experience it. And to experience it usually involves moving through three stages, A, B, C. The first one is usually called conscious incompetence. You're consciously trying to do it, but you're incompetent because you're just a beginner. And that's the reason most of us never try to one of these other ways of approaching life, because we don't want to be incompetent at it. We'd rather be a stick in the mud. That's my view. I'd rather be a good stick in the mud than make a fool of myself trying to shift over to lover energy. But if you try, you can quickly move up to conscious competence. conscious confidence. You have to think about it, but you can learn where that energy is and really experience it in yourself. And then it's not entirely satisfactory, but you'll see the logic of this. If you get really good, it becomes unconscious confidence. And unconscious isn't the right way to say it, but what it means is it's now second nature to you. You hardly even have to think about it in order to access it. You have a sense of when to move to it. Now, that theory from conscious incompetence through where it becomes second nature to you, that is the story of every hero and heroine's quest in all of world experience. Every myth, every fairy tale, every great literature until the modern age has told the story of the hero or heroine's quest. What is the movie that captures for the hero that sequence today? It's Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars was written to capture this process. And remember, Luke Skywalker, see the first one of the trilogy. Luke Skywalker, remember, he's an adoptive child. And his parents are saying, hey, you need to get on with your life here. You're on hold. And he says, no, I'm happy on hold. And then remember, the two robots get lost, and he goes searching for them. And Luke Skywalker stumbles onto a cave, and there's Obi-Wan Kenobi. And Obi-Wan Kenobi says, oh, I'm glad you came, because we really need some warriors. And Luke says, oh, I'm not interested in being a warrior. And they talk for a while, and Obi-Wan Kenobi says, by the way, your father was a great warrior. And Luke says, oh, I'm not interested in being a warrior. And then a little later, Obi-Wan Kenobi says, by the way, your father left this light sword for you. And Luke was kind of interested in the technology, so he flips it on. He goes, zoop, zoop, zoop. Well, that's conscious incompetence, you know. He zoop, zoop, zoop. He's a threat to everybody around. But he says, well, gee, that's kind of neat. What would it take to get really good? And Obi-Wan Kenobi says, oh, to get really good, you practice blindfolded. Well, to practice blindfolded, to do it blindfolded, is the metaphor for when it is now second nature to you. That's the hero's quest. What is the movie that tells the identical story for the heroine? Are any of you other puzzled? Was it 1991 Academy Awards year, 2 years ago, when Silence of the Lambs got all those Academy Awards? How many of you have seen Silence of the Lambs? If you haven't seen it, put the kids to bed and put it in the VCR. It's a terrifying movie, but it is the same story. It's Jodie Foster. Remember, she's an FBI trainee, so she's consciously incompetent, but she wants to get that power, and so she's joined the FBI, and she's going to get it. They pull her in off the training track, and they say, we've got a serial killer out there that we call Buffalo Bill, because he gets women victims and starves them and kills them and flays them. Now, he's intended to represent radical evil, and he does. I mean, that's really a terrorizing picture. And her task is to go use the mind of, was it Lechner? Hannibal the Cannibal, they call him. He's in jail now. He's actually a fellow professional, whose only failing is that he kills his clients and eats their organs raw. Now, every lawyer should see this movie, because that's a metaphor for what the public thinks we sometimes do to them. And her job is to use his genius to figure out where Buffalo Bill is. And her job is to locate Buffalo Bill, but not to go get him. Then you find him, and then we'll send for the troops. And the troops, you know, the real warriors will go get him. So the movie unfolds, and she gets closer and closer, and finally she figures out where Buffalo Bill is, and she's nearby the house, and he has the next victim in a pit inside. And her instructions are, don't you go in, you call the warriors. But she knows if she calls the troops that in the meantime, the next victim will have died. So she goes in the house. We're all saying, don't go in, but she goes in. And she gets in there, and the lights go off and the doors lock. So metaphorically, she's blindfolded, and she has to face this serial killer who has, of course, military glasses so he can see in the dark. So there's the same story. And it is the story of going, of realizing you don't have those qualities to where you consciously seek them and are able then to evoke them and use them to serve a higher cause. Well, that's the model for our development as lawyers, male or female. Well, let's see, any questions or comments or rebuttals you'd like to make from this morning, please. It's, I'll repeat the questions if I'm phrasing it right. You were looking in part at the... And the genetic studies would say genetically, you're born with the capacity to do all of that. And which one you pick up and develop early in life, nobody is quite sure why we choose which ones we choose. There's birth order theory, and there are different theories about why we might start out better as a healer, say, and we might have an older brother or sister that's better as a warrior. But the theory is we're all born with the capacity to be a complete or whole human being, and but we can't develop them all at once. So you develop one or two the first half of life, and maybe three and four the second half of life, so that it's not that you're genetically predetermined to one or another. So you really have the capacity for all of them. And to repeat the question, so we're all in on it, question was, well, is the better advice to pick one or another, say basically cooperative or healer mode, or basically aggressive or warrior mode? Pick one and develop it to the best you can, or should you be working to build both of them equally? And actually, there are two schools of thought on that. One school says, take your strength and build it, and don't worry about the rest. The other one, and my own view, says, no, if you want real satisfaction, what you do is you build on the one you've got, but you also try to add an ability, a capability for the other, so that you end up able to move, to operate out of both of them. Yeah, and the comment there is, well, the situation may well dictate, assuming you're able to choose either one, the situation would very likely dictate which one you might want to start out in. And that would certainly be my view, that against a very tough warrior, you ought not to start out in a healer mode, because you're going to get eaten up, because warriors don't respect except other warriors. And I would certainly agree with that. Other comments or questions before we go on, please.
In the stages that an individual passes through, you know, warrior to appear with the healer problem.
The question is, well, are they kind of stages that you pass through so that maybe there's a linear progression between them? A warrior to become mature would also develop the healer. And I guess I'm not sure. I think the theorists that work on it don't see it as linear, and they see it as a lifelong development process. But that there's no particular order you'd necessarily develop them in. But these are pretty interesting questions you're asking. They're really the points that aren't well settled. The bibliography in the back that begins on about. Begins on page 118 is the bibliography that I learned the basic material on with respect to human development, and I suppose on pages 118 and 119 would be all of the material that talks about development generally, and then on pages 120. We have elaboration of the healer archetype, and so I've given all of the sources that seem to me important for men and women to learn what it means to have strong healer qualities. And then on page 121, some references for the warrior archetype that would talk about developmental aspects of the warrior. So one way to do it is through books. Another way is looking at at movies. One question that is implied by yours is, what if you don't bother, what if you decide it's not worth it to try to develop mature quality other than those that are your current strengths? And on page 122, I've tried to address that. What happens when lawyers fail to develop mature healer and mature warrior quality? And it turns out there is very good research supporting the idea that if you are a mature healer, but not a mature warrior, that you are probably terrorizing some of the people in your life, including your clients, by unconsciously doing things not very well on the warrior side. And the only way to really stop being a problem is to develop conscious warrior qualities. And the same would be true if you don't develop your lover side, for example. But if you're a great healer, but you don't develop your lover side, then you get something like Jimmy Swaggart, who's a great preacher, but if the news reports are correct, ends up patrolling the seamy side of town looking for loose casual sexual relations, because it's not a mature part. He hasn't developed the part of him to have mature intimate relations with the opposite sex, or with other men or women, to have the mature intimate relation. So the theory is, to be whole people, we would develop all of them. But that's a bit far afield from negotiation, but it would be part of a larger task. Any other questions? We can return to that at the end. We might have a few minutes at the very end. But let us now focus right back down on negotiation at the street level. And I mentioned that there are four psychological principles at play in every negotiation, it appears. And I don't know how to talk about these principles except by asking you to react individually to some hypotheticals. And we'll be working here from page 89 of the material. And the first hypothetical, it's a bit fact poor, as they say. You don't have enough information here to make a reasoned decision, but just go along with it and see what you're likely to do. So suppose we all live here in Houston, and suppose there's a little theater group downtown that we consider to be very important to the culture of the community. And so we all try to go to at least a couple of performances a year. But the tickets are expensive. It's $50 a ticket. So we can only afford to go to a couple of performances. So there's a performance coming up that we all want to see. So we've all bought two tickets. And the tickets are $50 each. So suppose you have the two tickets. Now the day comes for the performance. You pick up the tickets from the bureau and you put them in your pocket or your purse. And you and your companion stop off for a bite to eat. And then just when you get to the theater, just before you go in the theater, you reach in your pocket or your purse and you've lost the ticket. And assume you're never going to find the ticket. You know, you call home and they're not home, and you look in the car and they're not in the car. Assume you're never going to find the ticket. And assume further, which might not be true, that you're not negotiating. So you can't find the manager and say, you know, those are my two seats, let us in. Your only choices are these. Either you buy two more tickets, or you go across the street to Circle K, rent a video, and go home. Okay, so just on that, what would you be inclined to do? How many are going to buy two more tickets? Okay, seven or eight. All right. Like, these are the ones that inherited some money. And then how many are not going to buy two more tickets? Let's see who's here today. Okay. Well, you're not exactly what a representative sample would do, but that's good enough. Now change the facts just a little. Same theater, same presentation, same price for the tickets, but you called ahead and reserved the tickets, and you haven't picked them up. And just before you leave for the theater, you take two $50 bills from the bureau. You go have with your companion, have a bite to eat. Just before you go in the theater, you reach in your pocket or your purse, and you've lost the two $50 bills. And you call home, and they're not home. And you check in the car, and they're not in the car. So assume you're never going to find the money either. but you have your charge card. So do you go ahead and buy the ticket, or do you rent a video and go home? Okay, on those facts, how many are going to go ahead and buy the ticket? Okay, should be just about everybody. And how many are not, by the way? Okay, three or four. Now let's think about this as negotiators. The question is, do you buy or do you go home? And in the first hypothetical, you have two pieces of paper, and on it is written ticket. And they're worth $50 each. And if you lost the two tickets, how many are going to buy two more tickets? If you were a random sample of the middle class America, about 15% would buy more tickets. A bit more of you would, but random sample, 15% would buy tickets, 85% would go home. In the second hypothetical, it was two pieces of paper. It's written dollars on them, but they're also worth $50 each. If you lost them with dollars printed on them, how many would buy? And the random sample U.S. would be 85% now would buy two more tickets. Only 15% would go home. And that shift from 15% to 85% drives economists crazy, because they say it is not rational. If you're perfectly rational, they claim, either you buy them both times or you don't buy them, because it shouldn't matter to you whether tickets or dollars are written on the piece of paper. Now, were you completely irrational? Those of you that changed your mind, why did you change your mind? Is there any reasonable basis for changing? Oh, obligation. Sure, that you've told them that you're going to buy here, and you haven't bought them yet. So you've a sense of obligation not yet completed. Okay, any other reason? I've already supported him here. Here I haven't yet. Of course, here I could twice split. But already you have. You've done your share. And I suppose if we wanted to, that there are a couple other reasons that you're sitting on. So let's get further reasons.
Okay, it doesn't matter what you buy or not.
There's something about, you're saying the tickets, I kind of charge the tickets to my theater account. The money, you haven't assigned it to account until you spend it, and so why would you blame the theater for losing the money? So, but to analyze it as negotiators, what we need to do is first grant you your reason for change. So if you change between the two, say, yeah, you had a good reason. Now, what would be the moral for us as negotiators? It would be to recognize now two principles. One is that people assign different kinds of values in ways that aren't necessarily rational. So people value things differently. In this hypothetical, which is more valuable, money or tickets? Which is harder to replace? Notice that if you lost two tickets, only 15% of middle class America could afford to replace two $50 tickets. You lose $100 money, huh? Easy come, easy go. 85% could replace the money. So our perception is that the tickets are more valuable than the money, which is, I think, the same point you were making. So in that sense, if you are representing somebody who caused someone else to lose tickets, and you say, well, how much were the tickets? $50 each. Well, here's $100. Only 15% of the time would that be satisfactory. 85% of the time they'd say, no, $100 can't replace two $50 tickets. No, the tickets are more valuable.
This is the end of tape 3, side 2. The program continues on tape 4.